Our epistle lesson this morning comes from James. I'm continuing the series that Llewellyn has started in James. James is considered wisdom literature. It's kind of in the same category as Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. So here's this wisdom that comes from actually Jesus' brother. Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers and sisters. For you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. For all of us make many mistakes. Anyone who makes no mistakes in speaking is perfect, able to keep the whole body in check with a bridle. If we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we guide their whole bodies. Or look at ships. Though they are so large that it takes strong winds to drive them, yet they are guided by a very small rudder wherever the will of the pilot directs. So also the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great exploits. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire! And the tongue is a fire. The tongue is placed among our members as a world of iniquity. It stains the whole body, sets on fire the cycle of nature, and is itself set on fire by hell. For every species of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature, can be tamed and has been tamed by the human species. But no one can tame the tongue, a restless evil, full of deadly poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this ought not to be so. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and brackish water? Can a fig tree, my brothers and sisters, yield olives, or a grapevine figs? No more can salt water yield fresh. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So, as some of you know, I've embarked on a new journey of my faith. I'm formally pursuing the possibility of becoming a commissioned ruling elder. A CRE can be commissioned for a particular service, such as being a part-time pastor of a small congregation, or serving the presbytery or the synod in some role. I don't know if that's where I'm headed. All I know is that I look around at the world and I realize that I need to do something. I don't know what that something is, but I'm at the least, I need to step out in faith and see where the Spirit leads me. So I'm taking courses online from the University of Dubuque, continuing my leadership here, devoting more time and energy to Common Call, our campus ministry. And then also Llewellyn will be asking me to fill in for her on a more regular basis. So the first set of lectionary readings that I'm preaching on after I made this big decision has this verse from James. Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers and sisters, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. Okay, now there's no coincidence, right? God just puts things in our lives to teach us a lesson, or to call our attention to something important. So the naive response is, okay, I'm on the wrong path. I'm not supposed to go down that road. It's God's way of rebuking me. So I could just stop here and walk away. But I'm not going to. I'm going to go ahead and read the rest of the passage and everything and see what they're saying to me and to all of us. James is speaking here of the power of words and the particular danger that comes with authority. We all speak with authority in certain circumstances. We gain authority by age, or by title, or by job position, or in some cases, just strength of character. We can all think of people in this church who are leaders, whether or not they're on session. When a person has some level of authority over others, there's extra strength in their words. At the university, I have a special authoritative role as a professor. In my class, there's a big power differential between me and the students. And so anything that I say has outside strength, right? Because I control their grades. As an advisor to graduate students, there can be an even larger power differential because at some level, I don't control their grades, I control their careers. There have been some discussions on campus lately about professors abusing this authority by asking grad students to run errands for them or whatever, which are egregious cases. But the more pernicious problem is a professor gradually leading grad students astray, having them do things that are good for the professor but not necessarily good for the student. And so you really need to be careful how you advise students, how you interact with students. So on campus, in addition to being a professor, I'm the advisor to Common Call, which is our campus ministry, and it's a registered student organization. But I have to be careful to draw a line between those two roles, right? Hypothetically, I could ask students in my class to come to Common Call meetings. I haven't found an explicit rule against that, especially since it's an RSO, but I'd never do that because that would be an abuse of my secular authority towards religious purposes. At the same time, the church needs to be careful about crossing into the political realm, into the secular realm. Speaking from the pulpit gives added weight to the pastor's words. Churches have long been active on social issues from slavery to temperance to civil rights to abortion. But there's a big difference between saying the Bible teaches us that all people are loved by God and have value, and so we advocate for or against a certain policy, or saying the Bible teaches us that we should vote for this person because they will do God's will. Okay, that's a big difference. The first one engages the church in ameliorating the pain and suffering of the world. The second one claims worldly power and divides people. So returning to the text, James says that those who teach will be judged with greater strictness, not just for their authority, but also for their teaching. We are called to proclaim the good news, but sometimes get the message wrong. I get a little angry every time I pass 10th Street in Pine and see that English corner, that little church plant, and they have a scrolling banner. And some of the things they say there really are not things that I agree with, and I don't appreciate them claiming to speak for Christianity as a whole. But that's not the only thing. You know, there's plenty of false teachings out there, so let's talk about a couple of them. The prosperity gospel teaches that if you believe the right things, you'll be blessed with wealth and a good life, right? Name it and claim it. I was first introduced to the prosperity gospel about 5 years ago when Rhonda was having her serious face pain. And some Sundays I'd stay home with her and we'd watch Joel Osteen together. Now, Osteen is an excellent speaker, right? He's eloquent, he's humorous, he has lots of examples to tie his message together. He's a great speaker. But he's teaching something that I think is just wrong. He's teaching that Christian life is easy, right? But we read in Isaiah about the sufferings of a prophet. We read in Mark about the sufferings of Jesus and his warning to his followers. Our lives aren't meant to be easy. The main issue I have with the prosperity gospel is the corollary. If faith leads to riches and well-being, then if you're poor and suffering, it must be because you lack faith. Right? So basically, this theology looks at someone who's a victim of circumstances and blames them for not being sufficiently faithful. Your home was destroyed by a hurricane? Well, you better pray for a new one. Or you can't get a job because you didn't go to college because your high school was terrible. Well, you better pray harder. The truth is that we are a promised abundant life, which is not the same as a life of abundance. Abundant life is relationships, it's love, it's joy, it's community and fellowship, not money. So then there's the teaching that James mentions in verse 9. With the tongue we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. This manifests in lots of ways. One way is the teaching in many churches that all people have inherent value and are worthy of God's love, unless they're gay, in which case they're going to hell. Another way is when we draw distinctions between us, whoever us is, the chosen ones, the frozen chosen, they used to call us, and them, whoever them is. People who are different in some way and therefore not really valued unless they can become like us. And that was the motivation behind many missionaries in centuries past. When they would go to new lands, they wouldn't value the people. They wouldn't value the culture there. Didn't see them as fully human unless they would convert to the missionaries' form of Christianity and the missionaries' culture, their typically European culture. And we see it today in the prejudice against Muslims and immigrants, and we see it in people who praise God on Sunday but ignore God's teachings on Monday. On Sunday, they welcome everyone with the peace of Christ, and then on Monday, they complain about them foreigners who are ruining the country. So another challenge churches face is truly welcoming people into fellowship with Christ. Too often, there's a veneer of welcome, but a reality of exclusion or internal politics or cliques. C.S. Lewis gave an important talk, the Memorial Lecture at King's College, University of London, in 1944, later titled The Inner Ring. The main thrust of it was that in most organizations, whether it's a business or a church or a school or whatever, there's two hierarchies. One is on paper, right? At the university, there's the president, chancellor, provost, dean, chair, professor, right? The other is an invisible hierarchy, and it's a mostly unacknowledged but very powerful division between those who are inside the inner ring and those who are outside. One of the roads to perdition is to say or do things to achieve that insider status and the authority that comes with it. You make one little trade of truth for power, and then another, until you find yourself saying or doing things that corrupt your soul. However, once we breach the inner ring, we find it altogether unsatisfying. First of all, it could be like an onion. You're inside the inner ring, but oh, there's a ring inside that, and inside that, and inside that. Or we may find ourselves surrounded by people who are just the same as the outsiders, except they happen to think of themselves as being better. In How to Think, which is a book I read recently, the author, Alan Jacobs, distinguishes between such an inner ring and true membership. If you're part of an inner ring, you're bound together by certain code words, certain myths that bless the insider and curse the outsider. You are required to be like-minded and to speak as your fellow insiders speak. Challenging the stated or unstated rules results in being cast out and ostracized. But in a group that experiences true membership, you're bound together by being like-hearted. You're free to voice unpopular opinions and to be loved in spite of it or maybe even because of it. You're allowed to ask hard questions. Each person is valued as an individual and yet seen as part of the group. It sounds a lot like a Christian church that is truly functioning as a part of Christ's body. It sounds like a church whose words match their actions. Words have power. Our words have power. So one could read this verse and think that James is saying it's better just not to say anything. Just take a vow of silence, because then we won't make any mistakes, right? But let's look at two of his metaphors, verses 3 and 4. If we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we guide their whole bodies. Or look at ships. Though they are so large that it takes strong winds to drive them, yet they are guided by a very small rudder wherever the will of the pilot directs. He is arguing not that we should stay silent, but that we should use our tongue in the service of our will, which should be God's will. He is arguing that we should not spread false gospels, but also that we should spread the true gospel. In just a few minutes online, you can find all manner of lies and half-truths. So here's one. Jesse, can you advance it a slide? The problem found with quotes on the internet is that they are often not true. From Abraham Lincoln. Okay, you can go back, Jess. So we know that that's not true, right? But the only reason we know for sure that that's not true is that Lincoln died before the internet, right? But there's plenty of more that are subtle, right? And here's one that's ironic. Supposedly, Mark Twain said, "A lie travels around the globe while the truth is putting on its shoes." As it turns out, that quote has been floating around since the 1700s, long before Mark Twain. But whoever said it, the sentiment was correct. Lies, especially lies that confirm an existing bias or belief, are often accepted and transmitted more quickly than the truth, which is complex and subtle and requires real thought. There's whole websites devoted to rooting out these half-truths and lies, like Snopes. In the recent kerfuffle about kneeling during the national anthem and then the Nike ad with Colin Kaepernick, there's two lies that stood out. One was Tim Tebow supposedly kneeled during the anthem to protest abortion and didn't have any repercussions. On the other side, they said that Michael Jordan quit the board of directors of Nike in protest against the Kaepernick ad. Okay, the truth is, yeah, Tim Tebow kneeled all the time in moments of silent prayer, not protest. And Michael Jordan was never on the board of directors at Nike and hasn't said anything about Kaepernick, okay? But those two messages have a truthiness, right? They seem like they ought to be true, especially if they confirm your pre-existing bias or notions. And so they're accepted uncritically and they spread. Here's another inaccurate quote. Allegedly, St. Francis of Assisi said, "Preach the gospel at all times, use words as necessary." The implication is that we are to live the gospel and to preach it with our actions, but never or only rarely speak about it. But Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote in The Cost of Discipleship, "A community of Jesus which seeks to hide itself has ceased to follow him. The motive may be Reformation theology, which boldly claims the name of Theologia Crucis and pretends to prefer to Pharisaic ostentation a modest invisibility, which in practice means conformity to the world. When that happens, the hallmark of the church becomes justitia civilis instead of extraordinary visibility. The very failure of the light to shine becomes the touchstone of our Christianity." All right, basically what he's saying is, if we engage in good works but do not speak out about Christ's love, then we're falling short of our calling to be the light of the world, the salt of the earth, the city on a hill. So what did St. Francis of Assisi actually say? Well, here's what I found on the internet, which has got to be true, right? He wrote, "It's no use walking anywhere to preach unless our walking is our preaching. That is, if you preach the gospel but fail to live it, your words are empty and powerless." So this is quite a different sentiment. He isn't saying that we shouldn't use words. He's saying that what we preach about who God is and what God does should match what we do as a response to God. As we just sang, "Though I may speak with bravest fire and have the gift to all inspire and have not love, my words are vain as sounding brass and hopeless gain." So it's hard. I know. I'm not real excited about talking about God outside the church. You may be thinking, "I don't know what to say," or, "I'm afraid I'll stumble over my words." Well, two of the greatest leaders in the Bible, Moses and Paul, were not great orators. They were just people who were wholly committed to their Lord. Or maybe you don't think you know enough about theology or ecclesiology or whatever. But here's what you do know. You know your story. You know the blessings that God has given you. And if you do a little reflecting, you could identify how God was acting in your life, in the lows, in the highs. Or maybe you're thinking, I don't want to offend anyone. It's safer just to not bring it up. Well, I don't particularly want to follow Isaiah's lead and turn my cheek to the one who pulls my beard out, but I'm trying to become more willing to be uncomfortable. I want to be comfortable being uncomfortable, if that makes sense. Paul described the church as Christ's body. That is, Christ has no physical presence on earth except through the community of believers. He has no mouth to speak but our mouths. So we should think of ourselves as Christ's ambassadors to the world. So what does an ambassador do? Does an ambassador go to a foreign country and stand on the street corner and shout about how great his home country is? No. Does he knock on doors to tell them about the American values and how great his nation is? No. No. Ambassadors build relationships. They see things from the other person's perspectives. They learn about foreign cultures and needs and priorities. They work towards establishing common ground. But at all times, they represent their home nation and its values. In a similar way, we must earn the right to be heard. As we live the gospel, as we love our neighbor, as we welcome the stranger, and as we comfort the afflicted, we build relationships. Once people know that we care about them as individuals, they can hear the good news that drives us. We can move from showing that we care about them to speaking about why we care about them. God loves us, and so we love them. God's grace flows through us. God's grace is available to anyone. Christ's message of reconciliation is meant to bring everyone into Christ's body, which is the church. So let's go forth now as Christ's ambassadors, as Christ's hands to work in the world, as Christ's arms to embrace our neighbors, and as Christ's mouth to share the good news that grace is available to all. Preach the gospel at all times. Words are necessary. Amen.